This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Cincinnati City Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld arrested Thursday on federal corruption charges, the third council member this year taken into custody for alleged bribery. One, Tamaya Denard, has already pleaded guilty. A second, Jeff Pastor, will have an update on momentarily, news out this morning. But first, Councilman Sittenfeld released a statement earlier this morning as well. He said, quote, "Thank you from the bottom of my heart for your incredible outpouring of love and support. It has lifted and comforted our family enormously. I am innocent. The allegations against me are simply not true." Sittenfeld goes on to say in the statement, "The attempt to portray proper assistance to a project bringing jobs and growth to our city that benefits the public is a gross overreach and an injustice." Councilman Sittenfeld said, quote, "I stand strongly on my record of public service, including providing help that's in the public interest to anyone, whether they have ever made a political contribution to me or not. My public service has always been guided by doing what's best for Cincinnati. Please know this, I do not give up and will not give up. I intend to keep fighting these false allegations, fighting as your elected council member, and fighting for our city and its future." That's a statement released just this morning by Cincinnati City Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld, who was taken into federal custody on Thursday. Mayor John Cranley also spoke of the situation at City Hall on Thursday. Here's part of what he said.
"Obviously, given the events, three council members arrested this year, we need to clean house. We need to clean up the legislative branch. As I mentioned last week, 95 years ago, Murray Ceasongood and a lot of other good people helped to reform the executive branch of the city. Civil service reform, merit, promotions. And now, obviously, we need major reforms to how city council functions. And so I talked today with the city manager and the city solicitor about what we can do immediately to look in to how this corruption could have tainted any city business legislatively, and look and work together over the next several weeks to come up with other ideas for reform."
That was Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley speaking Thursday alongside the wind, the traffic, and the church bells about recent arrest of members of council at Cincinnati City Hall. We're joined now on Zoom by WCPO reporter Paula Christian to talk about all this. Paula, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So Tamaya Denard was arrested earlier in the year. Then came Jeff Pastors just a couple of weeks ago and P.G. Sittenfeld just yesterday. We've got news just this morning about Councilman Pastor. What can you tell us?
Well, Councilman Pastor's attorney, Ben Dusing, tells me that he has a probable deal with the Ohio Attorney General's office that will be a likely voluntary suspension of Mr. Pastor from his seat. You might remember that Ohio Attorney General Yost moved for the suspension proceedings, I think it was on Monday, by filing some paperwork with the Supreme Court. And apparently they've reached a deal so that that process won't have to take place. But what that means is, if I understand it correctly, is Mr. Pastor will still collect his salary and his benefits from his city job as a council person. But if he's convicted, then the city can move to recoup all of that money.
So he will remain a council member?
Yes, that's my understanding. He's not resigning the seat.
And only risk having to pay back any money that he's being paid as a member of council should he later be convicted?
Yes.
Okay, that's Paula Christian from WCPO, who's our guest right now to talk about the situation at City Hall. And another interesting piece of information that emerged Thursday related to Councilman Sittenfeld's arrest, Paula, is that both Councilman Pastor and Councilman Sittenfeld were allegedly accepting bribes related to the same development, but it's been made clear, I guess, by investigators that they were doing this independent of one another?
Yeah, I don't really know what's better or what's worse. If there was a vast conspiracy where everybody was working together to take bribes on a development deal, or if they're working separately. But that's what the prosecutors say, is that You know, these were completely separate occurrences. And if you look at the indictments, the conversations are different. The text messages are very different. How the money is exchanged is very different. So apparently we have solo operators seeking bribes.
You noted in reporting yesterday, Paula, that the attorney representing Councilman Pastor, Ben Dusing, says that, quote, no one should draw inference that Mr. Pastor ratted on Mr. Sittenfeld or provided information to the government regarding Mr. Sittenfeld. Whatever the evidence against Mr. Sittenfeld, it did not originate from Mr. Pastor. So not only were they apparently not working together, they're not testifying or offering information against each other, according to the statements that are out. And I believe that includes some reporting we saw related to Tamaya Dennard, that she has not provided any of this information.
Well, when they arrested PG yesterday, the timing of the arrest, because Tamaya Dennard's sentencing is on Tuesday, and she's going to find out how much time she'll serve in prison and if she'll serve it through home confinement or if she'll actually be behind bars. My first thought was, is she cooperating with the government to receive a reduced sentence by helping in the case against P.G. Sittenfeld, who she used to work for? That's how she got her start, was in his office. And Jeff Pastor. So I reached out to each of their attorneys, and both of them said independently, Marty Pinellas, who represents Tamaya Dennard, and Ben Dusing, who represents Jeff Pastor, no, we are not cooperating with the government. Essentially, they did not flip. They did not rat out their city hall colleagues.
Paula, I know if you've looked on Twitter at all, you've seen a lot of comments in replies to news tweets about this, commentary tweets about the situation at City Hall, all basically asking, quote, what's next? Who's next? And interestingly, you published an article the day before P.G. Sittenfeld's arrest in which you asked members of council who are still there, have you ever accepted a bribe? And we thought this was very interesting, and we're so glad that you came on to talk about it with us. And I think we should start by analyzing what Councilman Sittenfeld's office said to you.
Well, I did not have a crystal ball. The timing of that story was purely coincidental. I did not know Mr. Sittenfeld was going to be arrested the day after I wrote that story. Well, you know, what I decided to do was in order to be fair to everyone is I sent emails to everybody's city hall address and asked, it's a very simple question, have you ever been offered a bribe? And would you like to weigh in on U.S. Attorney David DeVille saying there's a culture of corruption that exists at City Hall? You know, some council people got right back to me, David Mann, Betsy Sunderman, within hours and agreed to an interview. Others provided statements. You know, I reached out again with my story deadline. And, you know, when I published the story, Mr. Sittenfeld had not responded to me, had not responded to my emails. Neither did his chief of staff. And then when the story came out and they realized that they were not weighing in one way or another, if he had accepted a bribe or been offered a bribe, his chief of staff sent me an email and said, no, PG has not, which I initially found interesting because I didn't understand why PG didn't respond to me himself and had his chief of staff send the email instead.
We're talking with Paula Christian from WCPO. So that's PG Sittenfeld's office denying that Councilman Sittenfeld had ever accepted a bribe just a day before he was ultimately arrested and charged for doing so, allegedly, of course. And what did you hear from other members of council? Was it pretty unanimous in their denial? Or how I guess, can you describe the varying degrees to which the denials came out?
Oh, I mean, everyone was saying absolutely not, never. I've never been in that situation. David Mann even went so far as to describe, you know, what would happen if somebody had the audacity to do that. He said he would throw them out of his office and then he would consider what other steps to take. No, the overwhelming response was absolutely not, never. I also did not hear back from Councilman Wendell Young. He did not respond to my email and then he said no comment. So I don't have a response from him either. But for the remaining council members, they were pretty emphatic that absolutely not.
You had a no comment response from Wendell Young directly or his office, or was it just from no response?
From his office was a no comment.
Did you hear from any members of the current city council about what's necessary to address this so-called culture of corruption in the building?
Yes. I've spoken to Betsy Sunderman. She had a press conference earlier this week. So did Greg Landsman. They both want to see a charter amendment. What's interesting is the city lacks the capability to remove somebody from city council who's been charged with corruption. So you can have somebody continue to serve on council, continue to vote on legislation, continue to introduce new law while they are awaiting trial on corruption charges. The city lacks the mechanism to remove them. So both Betsy Sunderman and Greg Landsman want to introduce a charter amendment that would change that. In addition, Councilman David Mann, he wants to change how developers interact with city council. He says in recent years, it's gotten much more widespread that developers and their lobbyists will come directly to city council members' office and say, can we get your support on this deal that you're going to be voting on in 2 weeks? And David said, well, wait a minute, I don't even know what this deal is. I haven't gotten any kind of proposal or project from the city. Has it been vetted? What do we know about this? So the deal-making process has changed dramatically at City Hall in recent years, with just a lot more hands-on interaction between developers and the elected leaders who will be voting on their deals.
What kind of sense are we getting from covering City Hall about moving forward on reform? Because we should keep in mind that while three members of council have been arrested this year, only one is no longer a member of the council. Two are still actively members of City Council, Sittenfeld and Pastor. But you have two other members of council, Greg Landsman and Betsy Sunderman, who have offered up different proposals. And then you've heard from Councilman Mann. We heard from the mayor yesterday. How do you expect these folks to work together moving forward on what they might view as necessary reforms while there are still a couple of members who are the root of this?
Well, I don't think much City Hall business is going to get done in the next 6 weeks, to be honest with you. I had a conversation with Betsy Sunderman yesterday, and she said this whole corruption scandal is not only distracting council members from doing the city's business because they're doing interviews on corruption, and they're, in fact, having to try and choose new council members. If council members Sittenfeld and Pastor eventually resign, you know, their designees are going to have to find new council members for those seats. In addition, it's making it difficult for council members to work with one another because they don't trust each other, because they don't know who's next, who's going to be arrested next for taking a bribe. They don't know. They don't necessarily want their name on a piece of legislation with somebody else. And then also, you know, there is a rule that suspends the reading of legislation three times. Well, if you don't have seven votes for that, then it has to be read repeatedly at three different council meetings. Essentially, it just will slow down the business of City Hall to a crawl until this is resolved.
WCPO reporter Paula Christian, you can read her reporting at WCPO.com. Paula, thank you so much for the time you gave us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And on Monday's show, we'll continue to dive deeper into the arrest of city council members and what City Hall must do to regain the public's trust. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's not just Cincinnati City Hall in turmoil right now. The small city of Crittenden in Grant County, Kentucky, ousted its mayor just yesterday. We're joined now by Inquirer reporter Julia Fair. Julia, what the heck's going on in Crittenden?
Hey, Michael. Yeah, so this whole thing started in really April of 2019. That's when the mayor was sworn in as the ABC administrator. The previous mayor had also done that same job. What's different about this mayor and the previous mayor is that this mayor, Mayor Patton, she was paid around $2,000 from the city's account for her work as the administrator. And as soon as she was paid for it, a lot of people asked, should she have been paid for it? And, you know, there was a lot of discussion about yes or no, but last night at a public hearing stretched into midnight, and the city council decided to oust her.
Okay, so what was the charge that the council brought against the mayor?
So the way that the charges were presented were in the form of a question. And so there were three questions that council went over. One of them was, did Mayor Patton appoint herself to an incompatible office and vacate office of mayor? They answered that yes, that when she took this ABC administrator job, she should have vacated and also stepped down from office of mayor, and she did not do that. The other question was, did Mayor Patton violate Kentucky law by paying herself in excess of the approved amount of salary for mayor? The set salary for mayor in this town is $8,000, but her W-2 showed that she got $11,000 in 2019. And then the last question was, did this mayor, it's basically all about the pay. So basically council said, like, you should not have gotten this extra money for your ABC administrator position.
Earlier this week, the mayor, who I guess is now the ex-mayor, Camilla Patton, mm-hmm. had requested some time before this hearing so that she could talk to her attorney, but council didn't even allow her to have that. They just moved rather quickly, it seems.
Yes, this happened very fast. Council scheduled the public hearing that happened last night just on Tuesday. And at the Tuesday meeting, former Mayor Patton asked, like, hey, like, we can still have this hearing, but can we wait until November 30th? But council said no. They went ahead and did it last night.
We're talking with Julia Fair from the Cincinnati Inquirer. And we should note, Julia, that you credit the Grant County News for first reporting mm-hmm. this story. They did report this story. That's a weekly base there in Grant County. So is there any reprieve for former Mayor Patton? Is there an appeal process at all, or is this the end of it?
Sure, she can always appeal. And I did hear that she and her attorney did allude to her appealing. So we'll keep tabs on this to see if she does end up filing that appeal to get her seat back.
Yeah, we certainly will. It's a very interesting story. A lot of politics mm-hmm. comes out of Grant County. That's very interesting yeah. for being such low population. They really have some great stories mm-hmm. to talk about. Crittenden is just down 75 right across the Kenton County line into Grant County. And speaking of driving on 75, let's talk about the big deal on 75, Julia, the Brent Spence sure. Bridge. It's closed. We finally have a reopening date, at least a targeted date. It might be a bit of an early Christmas present for those of us wanting mm-hmm. it reopened.
That's right. It's supposed to reopen on December 23rd, which a lot of people were excited about. People were worried that this was going to be closed for months. So December 23rd was a welcomed estimated reopen date for a lot of people.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's going on there right now. I mean, the bridge is shut down. This is the bridge that connects Covington to Cincinnati by way of Interstate 71 and 75. It's a major disruption to really the nation's mm-hmm. economy. I mean, so much. I've read 3% of the nation's gross domestic product crosses this bridge annually. So a big disruption. We're certainly seeing a lot more big commercial vehicles in and around the urban core. But what type of repairs are taking place on the bridge as we speak after that fiery, nasty crash last week?
Mm-hmm. I know that they got some steel delivered earlier this week, so they are doing some steel repairs. But the bridge is not going to fall into the Ohio River. It is stable, so they are just doing a few steel repairs.
And that was welcome news to a lot of people who are watching this closely. I think people were scared after they closed for a second time river traffic, because mm-hmm. what does that mean to those of us who are amateur bridge watchers and thinking, why are you shutting the bridge down again to what might be going underneath it? And then mm-hmm. it looks like the Secretary of Transportation in Kentucky, Jim Gray, came out and said that the bridge is sturdy and it is fine and it's going to be repaired. And December 23rd is the time that we should be driving across it. But this has reignited conversation, Julia, of mm-hmm. course, about the Brent Spence Bridge, an ongoing theme of conversation in Northern Kentucky and Cincinnati politics. Two mm-hmm. presidents haven't been able to get this done. The region has had the Senate Majority Leader and the House Speaker at one time together couldn't get this done. March us yes. through the timeline of the story that you refer to, that the headline for your story says, the project no one can get done.
Mm-hmm. So everybody knows that this bridge has more cars using it than it was designed for. That's why it's functionally obsolete. More cars are using it than it was designed for. So there have been a few studies kicked around to see, okay, what can we do to alleviate traffic? And one of the ideas is to build a new bridge next to the existing bridge. So both bridges would be used in the future. that project with the bridge and some other, the new bridge and some other adjustments would be $2.5 billion. And there's a disagreement about how to find the local funds to match any federal dollars that would be used to fund that project. The local holdup is on Kentucky's side. Kentucky legislators don't want to burden their constituents with a toll. Ohio is fine with tolls. So it's really the Northern Kentucky delegation that has said no tolls to pay for this project. You are right. Two presidents have made a lot of promises about how to fund this bridge. In 2011, former President Barack Obama even stood at the base of the bridge and talked about legislation that would pry open funding for it. But that bill died in the Senate. Then in 2016, President Donald Trump promised to help the bridge as well while he spoke at a campaign rally in Wilmington, Ohio. That didn't happen either. So there's been a lot of kicking around to find funding for this project.
And let's note that Senator Mitch McConnell was just reelected by Kentucky voters, including the Northern Kentucky counties, on an argument that being the Senate Majority Leader means power for the state and still no funding for the bridge. His wife, Elaine Chao, is the Secretary of Transportation and has been throughout the Donald Trump administration. Still, as you write, no bridge. And I think we should also note, Julia, that Kentucky lawmakers are not just opposed to tolls. It's been written into law.
Yes, there is a law that really stops any legislation from funding this project with tolls. Former Governor Matt Bevin signed a law that specifically said no new bridge that connects Northern Kentucky to Cincinnati will be paid for with a toll. He signed that legislation in 2016, I believe. But then I think everyone will remember during his reelection bid in 2019, he backtracked and said no tolls have to be part of the answer. But that legislation still stands.
Well, let's talk about what business leaders and transportation officials in the region have to say about what the situation represents right now. You did talk with Mark Polizinski. He is the leader of the Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana, OKI, Regional Council of Governments. They have been proponents of a bridge project there.
Yeah. You know, there's everyone says we need a new bridge. We need to find a way to pay for it. And the new bridge seems to be what everyone is advocating for.
So what do they see as a path forward if it's something that they still think is necessary?
You know, I think everyone is really trying to still figure that out. Everyone has said no to tolls, but I haven't heard from legislators about what they could use for funding instead. I did talk to Brent Cooper with the Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce, and they support raising the gas tax as a way to not only pay for maybe this new bridge, but other infrastructure needs in Northern Kentucky. So it's a big funding question.
It is often noted that Kentucky's gas tax has not been raised in almost three decades, and the gas tax is what funds a lot of transportation projects. So we will note from your article that Brent Cooper of the Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce said that he supports what he referred to as, quote, a reasonable toll. He would support a dollar toll, but for example, he would not support a $4 toll. But right now, tolls are not even part of the equation. Governor Annie Beshear has held a couple of news conferences about the bridge, and we should note that his dad, former Governor Steve Beshear, was working with former Ohio Governor John Kasich on a project. They had had joint media presentations in Covington announcing how cooperative they had been together and what their plan would be, a 50-50 split, but still nothing. What does the current Governor Beshear say about the situation?
Are you asking about how he believes it should be funded?
Well, I guess you had written about how he doesn't think that had the bridge, I guess, been completed or expanded already under the administration of his dad or in the previous administration of Governor Bevin, that it would have prevented the crash. But he does want to get the project moving, right?
Oh, yes. Yes. He absolutely wants to get the project moving. We haven't gotten into the nitty gritty details about that, but this just further highlighted that this project needs to get moving.
And in the meantime, we're dealing with traffic, and the state transportation cabinet is trying to keep that heavy load of commercial trucks off the local roads. What are they doing to do that?
You know, I believe they are, I think they have some police officers out possibly redirecting traffic. But Kentucky Transportation Secretary did sign an order that said no commercial traffic in on local roads unless you're making like a local delivery. I'm not so sure about the enforcement. So that might be something that we need to follow up on.
And we will follow up on that because this story is probably not going anywhere anytime soon. Julia Fair is the watchdog reporter at the Cincinnati Inquirer for Northern Kentucky. Julia, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks so much.
And just ahead, Cincinnati public school students want police out of their district, and WVXU media beat writer John Kiesewetter on why he did not like the film adaptation of Hillbilly Elegy. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue the weekly news review now with WVXU's newest reporters, Corey Sharber. Hi, Corey.
Hey.
And Jolene Almendarez. Jolene, welcome to your first appearance on Cincinnati Edition. Glad to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks. I'm pretty nervous to be here.
Oh, don't be nervous. We're going to be gentle to you, and our audience is already enjoying your voice very much. We're glad to have both of you young people with us today on the program. Well, you both of you covered some COVID-related stories related to local governments. Corey, I will start with you. You profiled the situation in Hamilton County, which has issued an advisory for people to stay home. That's not really much of a mandate, but what's the situation in the county, Corey?
Well, right now, Hamilton County has confirmed more than 26,000 cases. Since last week, they've confirmed nearly 4,000 new cases, and this is going with the data they provided last week where they were seeing a week-to-week increase of 4,000. So things right now are getting really out of hand with COVID. And of course, on top of the cases going up, more people have been hospitalized and more people have been admitted to the ICU. In October, 80 people were hospitalized within the hospitals in the region. And now nearly 550 people have been hospitalized. And right now, the last time I checked, the number of ICU admissions is at 125. So things are getting really scary, really fast, especially right before two major holidays.
And Health Commissioner Greg Kesterman, Corey, is concerned about staffing.
Yeah, I mean, like people need to realize that, you know, there's only so much people can handle at one time, especially with the stress of, you know, dealing with a pandemic like this. Staff have been dealing with a lot of anxieties and whatnot. And of course, staff members can get sick as well. So again, like with the amount of people they have to take care of at one time, it's made the situation very difficult.
And the county is obviously hopeful about the vaccine. We're going to talk to Tana Weingartner coming up about the county's plan on how to store the vaccine here locally. But Corey, you also profiled Senator Rob Portman, who raised some concerns about not enough people maybe getting the vaccine once it's available.
Right. Rob Portman, during a news conference earlier this week, he talked about a Gallup poll from October that said only 50% of Americans would be willing to get a vaccine once it's available. Now, since then, the Gallup poll has been updated to show that that number has increased to 58% of Americans that are willing to get the vaccine now. But like his concerns are that, you know, this is a, you know, major issue we're dealing with. And not, if not enough people get the vaccine, then it's going to slow the progress towards getting out of the pandemic.
And Senator Rob Portman is so supportive of a vaccine that he's participating in a trial.
Yeah, that's correct. He's currently in a vaccine trial that's being developed by Janssen and Johnson & Johnson. He said that he enrolled in the trial because he believes this is how he can play a small role in supporting the country's response to the ongoing pandemic.
That's WVXU reporter Corey Sharber. We're also joined by WVXU reporter Jolene Almendarez. And Jolene, you profiled Mayor John Cranley here in Cincinnati. He expressed some excitement about a probable vaccine and that there might be light at the end of the tunnel, but people should not let their guard down.
Right. That's exactly what he said. He said that the news of the vaccine is so promising and a lot of people are so excited. In addition to that, just conversations about herd immunity and what's going to happen when enough people have gotten the virus has kind of slowly caused people to drop their guard about the dangers of the virus. Last Saturday, Cincinnati saw an all-time high of reported, I believe that was confirmed or probable cases, and Claremont County nearby also reported a high on Friday. It seems like pretty frequently every day or a few times a week, there are new reports of all-time highs of the number of people getting this virus. And so John Cranley reminded people that now is not the time to drop their guard, that now is the time to continue doing the things that they did all spring, wearing masks, using hand sanitizer, social distancing. And so he really had a lot to say about that earlier this week.
And just like the county health commissioner, Greg Kesterman, Jolene, we heard from the city health commissioner, Melma Moore, that local hospitals are reporting a strain because of the increase in COVID cases that they're seeing there. I recall, and a lot of us recall, back at the beginning of this thing, when we were unsure just how many people would be hospitalized, the Duke Energy Convention Center was set up to accommodate hundreds of people in case the hospitals were overwhelmed. Where does the city stand on whether that situation could return?
Right. So that closed down, I think it was in May. And the city says that right now they think they're a long ways from having to do that again. But they're saying that if there's another outbreak, if the hospitals get overwhelmed, that they are able to reset that up within a few days. It was always meant just for overflow. Now, I also talked to, and this is a little preview for what we have coming out next week, an occupational therapist at one of the local hospitals who says that within the hospitals, they're having the same kind of record-breaking number of people coming in. And she told me that every single day, that's something she can say just about every single day, that there's a new surge of people. And she also told me that every time somebody at the hospital gets sick, and this is what people fail to realize when we talk about understaffing, it's not necessarily that there aren't as many people employed, it's that when somebody gets sick, they have to take 2 weeks out to get better, a minimum of 2 weeks out. And when they get back, this occupational therapist told me that they are out of energy. It's hard for them to complete a shift. She talked about one person who just came back after having the virus, who was late one day because he couldn't get out of bed when his alarm went off. So it's a really bleak news coming out of the hospitals.
That's Jolene Almendarez. We're also joined by fellow WVXU reporter Corey Sharber. Corey, let's talk about COVID's impact on Cincinnati public schools. The district is preparing for remote learning again.
Yeah, that's correct. Due to all the COVID cases involving staff members, CPS has decided the best course of action is to return to remote learning. Now, they do plan on returning back to blended learning by January 4th, but then again, that could change due to how health data may change within just the next couple of months. Last time I checked, currently 217 staff members have tested positive across the school district since the beginning of the pandemic. And that's to go along with 127 students in CPS as well.
We hear a lot of pushback, Corey, when governments decide to close the schools as a response to a surge in cases. We just saw in Kentucky, the governor is shutting all schools down for the time being and possibly until January for a lot of them. And you hear a lot of pushback that it's not impacting students, that young people are okay. But you're talking about staff members are also at risk, and they've had how many staff members at Cincinnati Public Schools affected?
Again, I'm currently looking at the data right now. 217 staff members have tested positive since the beginning of the pandemic.
So what was the reasoning that district officials presented for closing down the schools? Was it those specific numbers related to their own infections, or was it the numbers that are happening in the city overall, or some type of combination of that?
Well, of course, it is a combination of it, because when you're looking at staff members within the city school district getting infected, that reflects on the community spread that's going on. I know that during the meeting, which they decided to go back to distance learning, Laura Mitchell said that the previous Friday in the city, we were averaging about 100 new cases a day. And then later that week, she said it was up to 500 new cases per day, and the positivity rate has been going up, not just across Cincinnati, but Hamilton County as well. I mean, it's again, just like we discussed earlier with the situations in the hospitals, the spread is just all getting out of control. And now everything has to be dialed back in order to protect the community at large.
Corey, at this week's school board meeting, some students from the district called for the removal of police from the district, school resource officers. What was their reasoning?
Well, when I was watching the meeting, Yusuf Munir, who's the president of the Young Activist Coalition, he said that police disproportionately target Black and Brown students, police meaning SROs. He says that he wants the school district to implement transformative and restorative justice. And essentially, I think he's kind of going at the larger narrative with, of course, we've seen, many of the protests across the country of the Black Lives Matter movement, as well as the protests involving police involved shootings of unarmed Black people in the country. And I think that narrative has kind of found its way here in Cincinnati Public Schools.
So students like Yusuf Munir, who is with the Young Activist Coalition, as you noted, made their case. What was the response from members of the board?
Well, they're pretty apprehensive because this is something that I don't think has been really considered by the school board so far. I did speak with Mike Morawski today about the situation. He said that, just removing SROs, if you want to tackle systemic racism, just removing SROs wouldn't necessarily do away with that. You can't just take away one part of a system and racism's over. That's just one little part of it. It's about tackling multiple sides of it. And with the anti-racism policy that's currently being drafted right now, and it will most likely be approved on Monday at the next meeting, they're looking at potentially working with SROs and to implement some sort of anti-racism training within the organization.
That's Corey Sharber, WVXU reporter. We're also joined by Jolene Almendarez from the WVXU newsroom. And Jolene, before we wrap things up, we're getting some new neighbors here near Cincinnati Public Radio's headquarters, the arts apartments at Music Hall. What's happening there?
Yeah, I'm so glad that I can inject a little bit of good news in here. So the arts apartments at Music Hall in Cincinnati. Right now, there are 83 affordable housing units there, but soon there may be 248 affordable and low income units. It's not that they're building more. It's that a company is coming in. It's renovating. The developer BH New Arts is renovating. They're redoing roofing. They're redoing plumbing. They're putting new appliances inside apartments. And this is part of their commitment to spend over $11 million to upgrade the 21 buildings at the site. In exchange, the Cincinnati City Council unanimously voted to give them a tax exemption to help finance the project. And another caveat of the project is that the affordable housing will be there for the next 20 years.
Jolene Almendarez and Corey Sharber, thanks to both of you for taking some time with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And let's turn now to a more senior WVXU reporter. We've got Tana Weingartner on the line via Zoom. Tana, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
I read on Twitter that even though you're working from home still, you got dressed for work today. So we're all very proud of you.
I put on pants, Michael. Real ones.
Well, listen, the COVID-19 vaccine storage preparations are underway in Hamilton County. What does that mean?
So the county will get an allotment at some point of COVID-19 vaccine to be used for first responders or to be given out at county-run clinics. So they have to find a way to store that because, as we know, the two sort of leading candidates right now, one needs to be stored at regular cold storage and the other one needs to be stored at really super, super Antarctica cold levels. So the county is fitting out some places to do that at an undisclosed location.
Wow. So this is sort of a top secret situation.
They're making it sound that way.
Why Hamilton County? It's not every county that's getting this, right?
Well, I think a lot of counties will get an allotment. This is going to be their allotment from the federal government.
Very interesting on how this is all going to play out. Okay, well, let's talk about another impact that COVID-19 is having on our region. And we've even done a show about this. People have been turning to Airbnbs as a way to gather and to get around some of these crackdowns on social gatherings during the pandemic. What is Airbnb doing about what are referred to as party houses here in the Queen City?
Well, they had said the, I think, end of last year that they were going to crack down on party houses. These are houses that, you know, somebody sort of rents for a weekend. And then rather than just having, you know, a couple of people come in to see the city or, you know, how you might use a rental home, they throw big parties in them. And a reminder that a lot of Airbnbs are in neighborhoods. So, you know, they're noisy and really frustrating to the people that live nearby. So they, Airbnb says, is suspending 23 listings in Cincinnati that have received complaints or have otherwise violated policies on parties and events.
Do we know where these listings are? Have they disclosed them? Are they in any particular neighborhoods?
They did not say where. They said that this was, you know, to protect privacy.
But Airbnb is pretty serious about this. They even have a hotline for neighbors to report issues.
Right. It's a 24/7 neighbor support line, they call it. And you can call that and, you know, at any time, obviously 24/7, and let them know if somebody is potentially violating the rules on parties. And they also, the company took similar action in Columbus and Cleveland this week as well, shutting down party houses there.
No Airbnb party houses. I guess that's
parties are out, Michael.
Scuttles our plans this weekend, Tana. I guess we'll just have to stay at home. It's too bad. WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner, so grateful for the time you gave us on this Friday. We'll let you get back to your very busy day of working at home.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Our pleasure. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Let's talk about a movie with some local ties. WVXU media beat writer John Kieswetter is on the phone with us. Hey, Kies.
Hey, Michael. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. So this is the book, Hillbilly Elegy, written by J.D. Vance of Middletown. You are John Kieswetter, also of Middletown. And I'm noticing that there are some pretty passionate feelings about people who grew up in communities like Middletown or more directly in Appalachia as it relates to Hillbilly Elegy, even when it was just a book. But now that it's a film, it's being pretty much universally panned, and that includes your review. You thought it came out to be like a comic book version of the original book.
Yeah, the book, J.D. Vance, you know, had a lot of subtext there, a lot of research about poor white people, and which explains the actions and the relationships that he portrayed in the book. But in the movie, it was strictly about the characters, and there's no attempt to give any kind of underpinnings. That was all stripped out, so you just leave with these crazy white characters doing, you know, fighting and yelling and everything. So it's not a very flattering book. And it really, the whole picture of the book doesn't come through when it was condensed into the movie.
Okay, so we're talking about a film that's directed by Ron Howard, who is a very well-respected and Oscar-winning Hollywood director. The movie was written by Oscar-nominated screenwriter Vanessa Taylor, who also wrote The Shape of Water. This movie stars Amy Adams, Glenn Close. When you look at this on paper, John, this is set to be a blockbuster, right? This is something that should sweep awards season. Were you surprised that at your own reaction to it?
Yes, I was. I mean, you're right. There was all the elements there. You know, it was a pretty high-powered cast. And yet, the bottom line, it was very disappointing. I grew up in Middletown. Actually, my dad grew up on McKinley Street, where J.D. Vance and his family lived. I know the town well. It's not the Middletown I grew up or I knew the Appalachian side versus, you know, the people that I hung out with or my family. But there was a good story there to tell, and it was just condensed so much that an awful lot was lost in translation.
You refer to it as the Middletown Hillbillies, and you talk about the way that J.D. Vance explores his own story of surviving, quote, hillbilly culture in Middletown. That's not something you experienced. What can you share with us about your own experience in Middletown? Is there that kind of culture where some people might view themselves as hillbillies and others not?
Sure. I mean, the Armco, the major employer up there, now known as AK Steel, for years, and this goes back into the 40s and the 50s even, actively recruited in certain communities in Kentucky to bring them up to Middletown to work in the steel plant. So there's, and they call them, you know, there's even a society up here in Butler County called the O-Tucks. And there used to be a joke among traffic reporters that that bridge would, I-75 would get jammed up on Friday night or on holiday weekends because everybody was going home to Kentucky. So there's an awful lot of that. But the middle town I grew up with, ARMCA was in its heyday. The YMCA was very strong. The Civic Association, Boy Scouts, Junior Achievement, they're all very strong. The Middletown Miami branch campus, the first Miami branch, was built there in the late 60s. There's this wonderful ARMCO park that was an employee association. So there's a lot, and Middletown had this, the culture that I knew where a lot of middle-level college-educated managers for ARMCO and their spouses who worked at ARMCO and then got involved with the charity ball or the Middletown Symphony and many different things. So I kind of grew up on the other side of the tracks, I guess.
This film, while set in Middletown in a lot of ways, there wasn't a whole lot of it filmed here, right?
That's correct. They went to the Ohio Film Commission in March of 2018, I guess it was, 2019, and all the film credits had been committed, so they went to Georgia, where it's kind of an open checkbook. But they did film 1 week here, and it was mostly exteriors of the homes. Actually, it was on Harrison Street in Middletown, which is two blocks away from McKinley Street, where the Vance family lived. But their depiction of Middletown, and this irritated me, in the movie, they show you go under this big concrete railroad underpass, and it's like a two-block downtown. It's something about the size of the downtown of Elmwood Place, when really the downtown business district in Middletown stretches from the Great Miami River to the railroad tracks, and it's about 10 blocks. It's mostly commercial. So it no wonder Variety called it a Midwestern backwater town, because it didn't look like a town of 48,000 people. It looked like a town that was so small it might even qualify as a village.
Hillbilly Elegy opened in theaters, select theaters, on November 11th. It'll be on Netflix on November 24th. So if you do want to check it out and make up your own mind, that's Tuesday on Netflix when you can stream Hillbilly Elegy. We've got about 30 seconds left, Key. So let's talk about something I think we can all agree on wanting to watch: the Charlie Brown TV specials. There was a little bit of controversy on whether we'd be able to see them, right?
Right. Apple had bought them actually 2 years ago, and it kind of flew under the radar until last month at Halloween, when The Great Pumpkin didn't air on ABC. It has had for years. And so there was such a backlash that Apple has cut a deal with PBS, and this Sunday at 7:30, PBS, which is 48 here in Cincinnati, 16 in Dayton, will air a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving, and then on Sunday, December 13th, the Charlie Brown Christmas will air one time only on PBS, in addition to be available on Apple Plus.
It's nice to have things to look forward to.
In a week, I'll post my holiday program guide that people have been looking for every year for about 35 years. So I'm in the middle of that right now.
We'll be sure to share that too. John Kieswetter, WVXU Media Beat Writer, thanks for your time again.
Hey, thanks, Michael.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives online at WVXU.org. Hope you have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. I'm Michael Monks.